Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, that wasn't so hard now, was it? The Senate passed the health care bill this morning. I figure a couple more meetings in Washington, this whole thing should be done real quick. Right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this day before Christmas 2009. You look at the calendar, tells you it's a Thursday today. The Senate did two things before it took off for its holiday recess this morning. It raised the debt ceiling by $290 billion. That'll let the government finance our deficit for about another 2 months or so. Also, there was that health care thing, which really means they're going to spend another month or so talking about it while the House and Senate reconcile their different versions of the bill. A lot of the details are going to change, and a lot of major provisions probably won't take effect for a while. But some parts should start as soon as something becomes law, one of which could help unstick the economy if it works. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
It was the end of another day at his corporate job when Matthew Blevins, a self-described computer geek in Northern Virginia, sat down with his fiancée at the kitchen table and wrote the list. Top 10 reasons stopping me from starting my own business. Number one was the recession.
Number two on the list of things was, like, we don't have any health care. In December of last year, I was diagnosed with diabetes.
So Blevins stayed in his job for the health benefits. One immediate effect of a health care bill might be to let people with pre-existing conditions afford private health insurance, injecting more mobility into the labor force. The Senate bill sets up a $5 billion fund, called a high-risk pool, to subsidize people who want to buy a policy but can't find an insurance company to sell one to them.
Uninsurables. The uninsurables who had resources to buy.
Sandra Shuri's been thinking about this group for a while. She founded a state high-risk pool in California in 1990 and ran it for 12 years. Most of the people they helped were the self-employed. The problem was there was always a waiting list.
It was heartbreaking. At some points, the waiting lists were several thousand people, in which case we didn't close the waiting list, but it stopped growing because I think people understood that there was no reason to be on the waiting list when it was that long.
A high-risk pool is by definition a money loser. The government covers the people that insurance companies won't touch. The federal program is just a temporary Band-Aid.
It's a complicated Band-Aid that's got arms and legs and holes in it.
Rick Curtis with the Institute for Health Policy Solutions in Washington says he expects this program to run into the same problems as California's did. Waiting lists, tight restrictions on eligibility. State officials worry the states will end up paying. Curtis says it lets insurance companies off the hook.
Insurers still don't have to take the high risks, and we'll take the high risks, and then you have to pay for it with tax revenues.
Blevins, the computer geek, is optimistic.
That's kind of like the killer app for the United States. It makes me happy.
Georgetown professor Karen Politz, an expert on high-risk pools, says it'll be a lifesaver for some.
I would definitely keep an eye on the program, and when it opens up, if you think you're interested, get your application in early.
In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
One of the many things that happened as the economy went south was that state budgets, which had been on a roll, were suddenly hammered by a drop in tax revenues. To make up the difference, a lot of those states have had to borrow to get the cash they need. They've hit the bond markets. So far this year, state and local governments have sold more than $60 billion worth of what are called Build America bonds. Those are bonds subsidized by the U.S. Treasury. And to drum up interest in their debt, states are taking their marketing message overseas, as Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
In a few weeks, the state of Illinois will try to sell nearly $3.5 billion in bonds to pay for contributions to its pension funds. John Sinsheimer is Illinois' director of capital markets. He says typically the state would find more than enough buyers in the U.S., but this deal's so big, it's pitching directly to European investors, too.
It will be the second largest bond issue ever done by the state of Illinois. So expanding to offshore investors just gives us more market and potentially more buyers to buy the bonds.
The more demand for the bonds, the less interest the state will have to pay. Overseas investors have already shown a taste for state and local debt. Matt Fabian is with Municipal Market Advisors. He estimates foreign investors have bought about 40% of Build America bonds. He says they pay slightly higher interest than comparable corporate bonds with a little extra security.
So AAA Utah, very low risk of payment default. It's hard to find something quite that safe in the corporate market, especially now with conditions still so uncertain.
But conditions for states are uncertain, too. David Blair follows the municipal bond market at PIMCO. He says investors might be cautious about a state like California, whose fiscal crisis has made international headlines.
There's a story to tell. There's some concerns about the credit. When you have those situations, going out and marketing it can really help keep the borrowing costs a little bit lower.
California sold $36 billion worth of bonds this year and needs to sell a lot more. A state spokesman says investors here may be suffering from California fatigue, so it makes sense to look further afield. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the bond market slumped a little bit in a half day's work. Equities did a bit better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I could do some long introduction here to set up our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond today, or I could just say this. Healthcare. The bill the Senate passed today comes in at close to $900 billion over the next 10 years. But the cost-benefit analysis works out to be some costs now and some benefits later. Here with us this week are Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine, also Mike Mandel. He's a former chief economist at Business Week magazine. Good to talk to you both again.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So we know, or I should say we've been told that, we're going to feel the costs of this plan, Megan, before we actually reap the benefits. Help us all out and give us some idea of what those costs are going to be.
Well, we're going to start off by actually having some benefits for people who don't have health insurance now. It's going to be slightly easier to buy it for people who have pre-existing conditions. You're also going to start doing some of the revenue collection, like the taxes on insurance companies is going to start over the next few years. That's going to phase in before the benefits start in 2014. So in the initial phase, it makes money for the system. There are a lot of questions about long-term how fiscally sustainable it is.
All right. Well, Michael, on that fiscally sustainable note, what are the long-term costs here? I mean, are we going to make money or not? The CBO says we will, right? The Congressional Budget Office?
I went back this morning. I was looking at that CBO report again. I just can't believe it. I actually think that this bill, you can think of it as extending coverage, which is good, and increasing costs, which is bad. And I think in the end, this is the right way to think about it. We've got all these moving parts going on, which Megan described, and at the margin, they're going to have an effect. But 2 or 3 or 4 years from now, we're going to look up and we're going to say, there was a big jump in costs here, and more people are covered, and that's the bottom line.
At which point, Megan McArdle, you're going to jump up and say, I told you so!
Well, I think that this isn't really a surprise. I mean, there's some element of people being disingenuous. The CBO scores the way it scores. It prizes consistency over accuracy. But they're not predicting the future. They're saying if the law goes into effect exactly as it is written, then this is our best guess of what's going to happen. But laws don't go into effect exactly as they're written. They end up being changed. And there's just a lot of uncertainty around these estimates. I think we're probably not actually going to end up with a deficit that's, $30 billion a year smaller in 2019, as the CBO says we will.
Are we going to wind up, Mike, as we do now with Medicare, saying, holy cow, man, where'd all these costs come from? And are we legitimately going to be surprised?
Depends on who you're talking about. Well, I think about healthcare reform as a two-step process. This step of the process is broadening out the coverage. Absolutely has to be done, including dealing with the pre-existing condition stuff. Then what's going to happen, whether it's 4 years from now or 6 years from now, we're going to have a genuine fiscal crisis. And at that point, they will be willing to do the things that they need to do to cut healthcare costs, the tough things that they're just not willing to do now.
So in reality, Megan, we have not, as the president said when he set out on this journey he took us on, we have not really bent the cost curve, have we?
No. I have to disagree on the question of, do we want to provoke a fiscal crisis for the purposes of reforming healthcare? I think that, you know, those things sound good when you talk about them, but they often don't work out the way you plan. The things that you want to be cut aren't necessarily the things that will be cut. And I would have preferred to start cutting costs and figure out how to control costs in the system that we have, and then gone on to expand coverage if that's what we wanted to do. But I don't think that this has made it more likely that we're going to get costs under control. I think it's probably made more likely that we're going to get costs under control when we do, in an ugly and catastrophic fashion.
I would agree with ugly, that it's going to be ugly. But if I had to take a choice, I would sort of say the boosting coverage is the right thing to do first and then cutting costs second.
Megan, what do you think of that?
I think that, you know, it is absolutely true that, you know, you shouldn't say, I don't want to expand coverage because of healthcare costs. But I do think that you have to think about what it means politically and how we're likely to end up doing the cost control when you've got this massive entitlement expansion that's going to be very expensive and, in my opinion, make it harder to reform the system because you've now got more stakeholders who don't want their benefits cut.
And the politicking will continue because we're nowhere near done on that one, but we are done for now. Megan McArdle, Michael Mandel, thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you.
Germany doesn't get quite as much sun as, say, Hawaii does, but it still has one of the biggest solar energy industries in the world. That's thanks in part to a law that gives cash incentives to makers of solar panels and also to people who contribute to the national power grid with solar panels of their own. One of Germany's wealthiest families wants to cash in on that policy and build a giant solar park on its land, but residents of a nearby town are saying nicht in my backyard, as Kyle James reports.
At the Turnentaxis Castle in the medieval town of Regensburg, the commoners are enjoying a Christmas market in the courtyard. The nobles who live in this grand estate once ran all of Europe's postal services. Now they want to deliver something else, green power. The head of the family is 26-year-old Prince Albert, the world's youngest billionaire. He wants to invest $165 million and build the world's largest solar park on his land. Family representative Stefan Stehl says the project would benefit the family and Germany.
Locally produced power keeps the value that comes from energy production here at home. Right now, the money spent on oil and gas from Russia or Saudi Arabia creates value there, but not in this region.
The solar park would cover a large strip of land, some 470 acres. At peak times, it would generate enough electricity to power some 18,000 households. Still, despite the enthusiastic support most Germans have for renewable energy, a cloud has darkened the aristocrats' plan. A tractor engine and the occasional car are about all that disturb the bucolic landscape near the small town of Feldkirchen. Barbara Unger is the mayor there. She's led a campaign to stop the Prince's project, which would border her town. She stands before miles of wheat and sugar beet fields.
Just look at this beautiful landscape. It's right on the Danube, one of the most fertile parts of Germany. We're going to lose all this farmland to solar panels. It's going to affect our quality of life here, and residents are worried about the value of their homes because those values will fall.
Mayor Unger insists she has nothing against solar power, but the idea of living next to a strip of gleaming glass panels 2 miles wide moved her to start her protest. Not with a mob and pitchforks, but a petition. However, she adds, both the nobles and the neighboring city have pretty much brushed her concerns aside. Straubing is a small city just a few miles away, which wants the solar project to go ahead. The city stands to earn over $1 million a year in taxes from the $25 million the prince will likely make. Oliver Wetter-Gindeli heads the city planning department. He doesn't think much of these kinds of not-in-my-backyard protests, especially given the urgency of energy and climate issues today.
Each individual community and each region needs to ask itself, how can I contribute to addressing and solving these problems? Always saying, oh, let the others do it. That doesn't help much.
But as Germany's solar sector grows, more of these kinds of NIMBY fights look likely. In another blue-blooded row, residents recently forced a German baron to cancel a solar park plan for his lands. And since Germany is so densely populated, almost any solar park is going to butt up against somebody. Back at the Thurn und Taxis Castle, Stefan Stahl says the family is waiting for final approval by a Munich court and hopes to be generating power by the end of next year. But delays beyond that would make the project less attractive financially. Government tax breaks would expire, and the scheme might be scrapped. That, he says, could set a dangerous precedent.
Germany could lose the key position it now has in renewable energies. A solar park doesn't smell, doesn't make noise, poses no danger to people. If you can't build a solar park, what can you build?
And, he says, since the solar sector employs about 80,000 in Germany, no one should want to see projects getting shelved. In Regensburg, Germany, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Coming up, affordable housing from luxury condos.
We've had 30 projects that we've talked to at length about the program. We've had dozens and dozens of other phone calls inquiring about the program.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Christmas definitely came early on Wall Street today as traders wrapped up the holiday-shortened week at new highs for the year, although volume was thin. The Dow Industrials dashed up 53 points, about a half percent, closed to 10,520. The Nasdaq pranced 16 points higher, 0.7%, 2285 at the bell. The S&P 500 danced up 5 points, a half percent, finished at 1126. Steady gains all week, added 1.9% to the Dow since Monday. The Nasdaq jumped 3.4%. The S&P 500 rose 2.2% over the past 4 days. We are going to have to call it a Santa Claus rally for memory chipmaker SanDisk. Analysts say there is no other apparent reason for a 52% run-up in that stock's value over the past 3 weeks. Today, SanDisk shares advanced another 6.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org. Just give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up on December 25th. No trading, markets are closed. It should be a white Christmas for many in the central U.S. Storm watchers are calling it a holiday blizzard. Be careful out there. And no snow where you are? How about a Slurpee? 7-Eleven anticipates its busiest day of the year. Almost all of them are open around the clock. Last-minute gift offerings include calling cards, lottery tickets, and candy. Everyone loves candy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There has been no shortage of big news this year. Healthcare reform, the financial crisis, how much Tiger Woods and his transgressions will hurt golf. All right, that last one might not really count as a major story for a program about business and the economy, but it is too good a segue to pass up. We've been asking some of our regulars for their lists of economic news that didn't quite make the headlines. And commentator Betsy Stevenson points out that despite all the bad news this year, something positive is going on.
Just about every day this year, we've been assailed by the latest statistics telling yet another bad news story. But there's been a good news story that hasn't received its due. Divorce is down. This year will record the lowest divorce rate since 1970. You might be tempted to credit this decline to the economy. After all, who can afford to get divorced these days? But that's missing the bigger picture. Today's low divorce rate is part of a steady decline that has now lasted 30 years. Yes, you heard that right. Divorce has been falling for the last three decades. Unfortunately, media reporting on divorce just hasn't kept up. It is true that around one in two marriages among my parents' generation ended in divorce. But they were unusual. They married in the tumultuous 1970s, and their generation has been more likely to divorce than either their parents' or their children's generations. So, is it still true that one in two marriages will end in divorce? Probably not, but we'll have to wait and see. The early numbers look good. My generation has been celebrating more anniversaries than our parents. I've crunched the numbers, and those who married in the 90s were about one-fifth less likely to have divorced in the first decade of marriage than those who married in the 70s. Those who wed in the noughties are also divorcing at slower rates. Now, there's still a chance that half of these recent marriages will end in divorce, even with a lower annual divorce rate. You see, it's a sad mathematical fact that all marriages must end by either death or divorce. And in this horse race, divorce may pull even, but only because advances in healthcare mean that death is slowing. So, we might live long enough to see half our friends' marriages end in divorce. But the good news is that those marrying today are more likely than ever to be physically able to celebrate a gold or platinum wedding anniversary. And more of my generation is striving to keep their marriages as healthy as their hearts.
Betsy Stevenson is an assistant professor of economics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Tell us what you think about what you hear on this broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. You can see the debris left by the collapse of the housing market in cities and towns all over the country. Acres of empty homes in Las Vegas, foreclosed properties in Chicago and Dallas, and in New York City, what would have been luxury condominiums. The city's construction boom went bust so fast, some of the buildings there aren't even finished. There have been some proposals to turn those condos into affordable housing. Buyers or renters would have to meet certain income restrictions, and the prices would have to be cheap enough for them to be affordable. But Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us that affordable housing is as much of a tough sell as granite countertops and bamboo floors.
Queensboro Plaza is just a couple of stops out of Manhattan. I come through on my way to work. The tracks are elevated here, so the platform looks out over the landscape, which is covered with construction sites and new condo buildings. Places like these popped up all over the city when credit was cheap and real estate was expensive. When the economy fell apart, so did a lot of these projects. In some cases, the developers couldn't afford to finish them, and in others, buyers just weren't interested anymore. I took a train downtown to meet Rafael Sestero. He's the Commissioner of Housing Preservation and Development in New York. He's worried that these kinds of open construction sites and empty buildings could bring blight back to New York.
We don't want vacant buildings, buildings that are unable to sell, unable to rent up. We don't want those buildings and the fact that they are vacant to further destabilize the market in those neighborhoods.
What the city does want is more affordable housing. So it came up with a plan, a subsidy for anybody who converts a stalled project into affordable housing.
We've had 30 projects that we've talked to at length about the program. We've had dozens and dozens of other phone calls inquiring about the program.
Ron Molis made one of those calls. He's CEO of L&M Development Partners. It's a company that builds affordable and market-rate housing in the area. He found a building he thinks would work. He won't tell me any more about it because he's still negotiating with the lender. He said there are benefits to taking over a project that's ready to go.
You don't have a lot of the hassle of buying property, building a new property, and taking market risk.
Because there are other risks.
You don't want to take over the project and then have someone coming after you for either not doing a good job on the construction or the buildings department looking at this and saying the papers weren't filed.
And for the owners, it might not make financial sense. Chuck Brass works at Forsyth Partners. It's a real estate consulting firm that specializes in affordable housing. He says in a lot of cases, it costs so much to build these projects, the developer just can't afford to make the switch. And the city subsidy isn't enough. I asked him at what point getting some money would be better than getting none.
Well, that ultimately really depends on whether, the market rate that they could sell the property at, even if it's at a loss, still yields them more money than what they can make through any government program.
He says there are other reasons that sitting tight makes sense. One is that interest rates are very low, so the owners have more money available than they thought. And the other is banks are willing to cut developers some slack because they don't want to have those losses on their books. Sestero, the housing commissioner, says the banks are still optimistic about New York real estate.
And I think lenders see that, and they're not willing to give up yet, if you will. And they want to try to make the deals work, and they're willing to do concessionary pricing, concessionary rents, and all of those things to try to make the projects work.
But nobody knows how long these lenders can hang on. 140 banks have already failed this year, and the commercial real estate market isn't showing any signs of improvement. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final thought this Christmas Eve. If you happen to be a regular listener to this broadcast, you might think we always associate the holidays with retail spending. The real value of this season, though, has little to do with ready access to a shopping mall. In fact, the farther you are from a chance to spend money, the more these holidays might mean. Correspondent Jake Wargo went to Camp Spiker, an army base in northern Iraq, to ask some of the soldiers there what they want for Christmas.
I just want to see my kids for Christmas.
I would like cattle for my farm for Christmas.
I want my kids, Jacob and Kirsten, to have a wonderful Christmas, and then my son, Jacob, to have a wonderful birthday that evening because it's also his birthday.
For Christmas, I just want all the soldiers to come home. I hope all the soldiers come home safe.
While you're over here, it gets you thinking about what's really important, and missing home is the biggest thing on people's minds right now. So anything from their loved ones, their wives, their families, their moms and dads, anything that's truly heartfelt, that's what feels the best over here.
Only thing I'd like for Christmas is to go home, I guess. Got everything else I need. Could go for a beer right now. A beer would be nice, but yeah, I'll have to not worry about that right now.
And for Christmas, I just really would want to have some time home with my family, but I have a family here also, and we're all doing great things over here.
From Camp Spiker in northern Iraq, that was Sergeant First Class Siatu Quarterman, Sergeant First Class Claudia Bullard, Staff Sergeant Brian Allen, Specialist Nico Kane, Staff Sergeant Robert Lacomi, First Sergeant Gregory Roman, and their fellow soldier, Simon Welty. Believe me when I tell you, it's no fun to be deployed over the holidays, so thanks, guys. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Christmas Eve. Today, the Dow gained 53 points. That's 0.5%. The NASDAQ welcomed another 16.7%. The S&P 500 took on 5 points. That's 0.5%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, what is the cost of a partridge in a pear tree? Well, it kind of depends on the partridge, actually.
The price on Hungarian partridge is 13 and a quarter each. But we actually sell two different types of partridge here. The Chukar Red Lake partridge, it's a crossbreed.
Who knew? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.